Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today. Casey Means is President Trump's nominee to be the U.S. Surgeon General. In this episode of Care Talk, Kayla Hancock at Protect Our Care digs deeper into Casey Means' background and why she is dangerously unqualified to be America's top doctor. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcasts wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. Today, we're talking about Casey Means, a wellness influencer and close ally of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. She was nominated by President Trump for Surgeon General on RFK Jr.'s recommendation. So welcome to Kayla Hancock, the Director of Public Health Watch at Protect Our Care.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So let's start with, what is a U.S. Surgeon General? What do they do?
Yeah, so the Surgeon General is generally known as the nation's doctor, more or less. And their job is really to provide folks with the best, evidence-based scientific information available on how to improve their health and generally reduce risk of illness and injury in the population.
So Trump nominated Casey Means, and he actually nominated her a while ago, but she was pregnant and had a baby during her nomination. And so that delayed things. And so now it's 2026. Who is Casey Means?
Yes. So Means is best known as a wellness influencer. She is neither a board certified physician nor the holder of an active medical license. She dropped out of her residency after, I think, 4 years right before she was supposed to be done with said residency, and has actually never practiced medicine unsupervised, from what I understand. And yes, so despite this, Trump has nominated her to the position of America's public health doctor, or America's doctor, which would essentially give her free license to direct public health guidance and advise Americans on best practices in public health. And so, I mean, aside from the sort of major elephant in the room of her sort of general lack of qualifications, she's also gone on the record opposing things like birth control pills, the newborn dose of the hepatitis B vaccine, really unpopular and sort of dangerous positions that we continue to see coming out of this administration, and that RFK Jr. And others have really made the pillar of their tenure here. And so, a lot of what we'd expect to see from Means in this position would really be continuing to undermine kind of public health and evidence-based medicine.
Why do you think President Trump, under RFK Jr.'s recommendation, or why did RFK Jr. recommend somebody that is not a licensed doctor and doesn't have the experience of seeing patients to be America's top doctor?
I think there's a few theories, but I really do think that Means would really only add to, you know, this, the ranks of sort of wellness grifters and skeptics at HHS who are fundamentally like opposed to evidence-based medicine and science in general. This is a pattern that we've seen come from, you know, RFK Jr. at the helm of this agency. And I mean, I think it definitely fits sort of the structure of what they were hoping to make HHS out to be. Definitely, and we can talk about this a little bit, but curious to see how this plays out for them in terms of an actual confirmation for her, as it seems like more broadly, the Trump administration is realizing that a lot of this sort of anti-science, anti-vaccine work is deeply unpopular. And so I think that the recommendation is coming from someone, you know, RFK Jr., who's made his career and really made his name in promoting, you know, this vaccine skepticism and sort of questioning evidence-based medicine. And I think this, you know, her nomination would really kind of solidify that as a best practice, so to speak, of public health under an RFK.
Mm-hmm. I think it's ironic that RFK Jr. talks about gold standard medicine, and yet they're putting forth people and policies that hurt science, scientific research, and medicine, including nominating someone to be America's top doctor who is not a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, at a bare minimum, the responsibility of the Surgeon General is to educate the public on how to avoid serious health risks. And I mean, Casey Means last month had her hearing in front of members of the Senate, where she wouldn't even encourage Americans to get vaccinated against measles amid the worst measles outbreak in over 30 years. Like, so this is, I just don't think that this is necessarily someone who really has any intention or ability to do that job well, given, you know, the inability to even recommend something that's been proven to prevent measles really from spreading. So, you know, it's kind of par for the course, I think, for what we're seeing from this administration in terms of just elevating folks to jobs that they have no business performing.
So she was nominated several months ago. She's had this hearing. How does the process work? How does somebody actually become Surgeon General? What happens next?
Yes. So as I mentioned, last month was her confirmation hearing, where she was given the opportunity to, you know, answer questions, and folks had a lot of questions for her. As I said, she would not commit to encouraging Americans to get vaccinated against measles, among other answers that were definitely concerning. And so to advance through that committee, they would need to vote for her out of that committee and then have a full Senate vote. So far, we haven't seen any movement on her nomination after that hearing. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on it at Protect Our Care and trying to see what comes of that. It seems that there's not a consensus around her from Republicans on the committee. So, you know, I think there was definitely some questions that left folks a little bit more with more questions than answers, frankly. So we'll see what happens. But as of now, there's no immediate timeline outlined for her confirmation. But generally, I would assume they would try to advance her relatively quickly out of the committee. But again, we haven't really seen much on that front.
Yeah, usually there's a vote, you know, right after the committee hearing, but because that doesn't happen, it sounds like there are not enough votes for her to become Surgeon General.
Yeah, it's starting to seem like that. And I do think, and I mentioned this briefly, that there is a little bit of consternation on how does this person, who I think at the onset of the Trump administration really fit the mold of like questioning vaccine safety and science and the efficacy of all of this modern medicine, how do they fit the mold now that we're realizing that, oh, this is harming a lot of people and it's not super popular? And so I'm wondering if maybe some folks on the committee are grappling with that. We'll see.
Exactly. I can understand why people have questions and problems with the American medical system, which, it costs more than other countries and delivers less care for most Americans. And when people get shuttled in and out of their doctors and just get a few minutes, and it feels like we do not have the best healthcare system in the world on a day-to-day basis. And I can see why people turn to wellness influencers and alternative sources because not we they are not getting good information from the people that we want to get medical information from. But all that having been said, I think that people with questions or concerns about vaccines or other basic blocks of public health are seeing when their friends and neighbors become sick. And kids are getting sick and dying of measles. I think perhaps people are thinking through their choices differently and recognizing that not getting vaccines or basic preventative treatments leads to really bad outcomes.
Right, exactly. And I think there's also we're seeing recent studies have come out just the other day, or polling rather, showing that more and more Americans are turning to medical associations like the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics for their guidance and for their medical advice, which ultimately is a good thing, but it's sort of showing a troubling trend of folks who are like there's no real trust in the CDC and some of these historically established institutions that have really helped set the standard for public health. And I do think having someone like Casey Means, and like RFK Jr., who we have right now at the helm, is really threatening that trust in institutions and generally threatening our public health.
Right. I mean, it's scary times when the people that have been put in charge of health in America can't necessarily be trusted. When something comes out of these agencies, official news or word or recommendations, and it's questioned, and it shouldn't be like this. But here we are. So, everyone that's listening and watching that has concerns about Casey Means, what can or should they be doing right now?
I do think that, as I just mentioned, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen in the Senate. And so we'll be holding tight on that. I don't know that she will even make it to this level, but I think beyond that, from a public health standpoint, I think it's important that folks are listening to these more these medical institutions like the AAP, the AMA, and following that guidance and continuing to listen to their doctors. I think the latest guidance coming out of the administration has really confused some folks. And so I think that's my recommendation is to listen to the science, listen to the scientists, listen to the medical experts. We'll try and get through this period of attacks and assaults on public health.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just the information that came out about whether pregnant women should take Tylenol or not. There are public health proclamations coming from people that are not doctors or medical professionals. President Trump is not a doctor or a medical professional. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is not a doctor or a medical professional. If they are giving medical advice, you should run it by a medical professional first.
Yeah, and I do think it sort of shows, and I think Casey Means is a great example of this sort of like JV style you know, quote unquote research that, you know, RFK Jr. and others are conducting and then blasting to the American public as fact or as public health advice. And that's what's really frightening. I think the Tylenol example is a great one of, you know, very cherry picked anecdotal, you know, things from stories or folks or information from, you know, a random study here or there, for example, on, you know, links between Tylenol and autism or, you know, all of these different things and whether pregnant women should be taking Tylenol. And people are listening to this advice. There was just recently shown that ER visits for pregnant women, there was, you know, there was less acetaminophen given to pregnant women, which is one of the only pain relievers that you can take when you're pregnant. So beyond, you know, bad public health advice and, you know, this is, you know, they're saying this to the American public, but it's really having an impact on patient care as well. And so I do think that even if, you know, they're not enacting policies immediately or things are getting overturned, there is a real danger in having folks like this in these positions of power pushing this rhetoric and really confusing the American public and parents and, you know, vulnerable populations.
Exactly. And putting our health at risk.
Yep.
So thank you very much for joining us, Kayla Hancock from Protect Our Care. Just a reminder, we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer some of your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, the health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Rachel Madley, the executive director at Center for Health and Democracy. So let's start with a question from STLHD on Blue Sky, who wanted us to discuss fair market pricing and open access. Two things being offered and pushed in my daughter's ER health plans by United Healthcare, and never heard of these before. So, Louise, what is fair market pricing and open access, and how does that, what does that mean in an insurance context?
Sure. So, fair market pricing is just, it refers to a way of that health plans, and it's usually we're talking about self-insured health plans, which is the majority of employer-sponsored coverage, is self-insured, meaning in this case, you know, they're mentioning United Healthcare, but it's a very good odds that United Healthcare is just the administrator and that it's actually a self-insured plan, meaning the employer is the one paying the claims and it's just being administered through an insurance company. That is the majority of employer-sponsored coverage. So fair market pricing just refers to a way that they come up with what the plan will use as, you know, you may have heard in the past, like people talk about reasonable and customary charges. It's typically, this is going to refer to out-of-network care, because within network care, there's just a contracted rate. The providers that are in network have agreed to a certain rate with the health plan, and that is what it is. When you go out-of-network, if the plan covers out-of-network care, which a lot of plans don't, but a lot of plans do, especially PPOs are the predominant plan for employer-sponsored plans, so they do cover out-of-network care. But the tricky part becomes when a plan covers out-of-network care, how do they determine what they will pay? Because there's no contract between the provider, the out-of-network provider, and the health plan. So fair market pricing is just a way of using like kind of a detailed algorithm for figuring out, instead of just doing like a percentage of Medicare, a percentage of what Medicare pays, which is a method some plans use, fair market pricing is looking at all sorts of little nitty gritty details, like the exact geographic location and what other providers get paid. And then they're using an algorithm to put it all together and come up with an amount that they consider basically the fair market price. And it does tend to be lower than other strategies for figuring this out. So employers like that because they get to pay less. The really important thing to keep in mind as the consumer, the patient, if you are in a plan that covers out-of-network care, regardless of how they calculate what they will pay, the provider can balance bill you unless you're in a situation like where it's an emergency that's protected by the No Surprises Act. The provider can balance bill you. So if you choose to go to an out-of-network provider and fair market pricing is being used, that might mean that the amount the health plan pays is lower than it would have been if they'd been using a different method for calculating what they're going to pay. And regardless of the situation of how they come up with that number, the provider is free to bill you up to their billed amount. They do not have to write off any amount of the charges. So that's just always something for people to keep in mind. If you're on a plan that has out-of-network coverage, just be aware that there's never any restriction on the provider billing you beyond what the plan considers the fair price, because there's no contract with that provider. So that's the fair market pricing. Then open access just means a plan that isn't requiring you to get a referral to see a specialist. And in this case, we're talking about HMOs and POS plans, because the other type of plans, which is PPOs and EPOs, they already don't require a referral to see a specialist. So, but in like your traditional HMO or POS point of service plan, traditionally you've had to, you can't just go to a specialist in the network. You have to first go to your primary care doctor, get a referral, and then you can go to the doctor that you're referred to. If you have an open access HMO, it just means you do still have to stick within the network, but you can sort of self-refer. You can go if you, you know, feel like you need to go see an orthopedic surgeon, you can go directly to the orthopedic surgeon without having to contact your primary care provider first. Now, your health plan might still require prior authorization. So it's not just carte blanche to go do whatever you want. You do need to check and see if you need prior authorization, but if the plan is open access, you don't have to take that extra step of visiting your primary care doctor, getting a referral. So those are just terminology to know about if you're looking at comparing multiple plans that are offered by your employer.
Thanks, Louise. And next we had a question from Dagmar from Texas, who called in. And Dagmar said her husband is on Social Security and Medicare, but Dagmar turns 65 in June and then becomes eligible. They had a one-time property sale in 2022, but they're getting letters from Medicare now, years later, saying they owe money because of a higher income, and they are now being charged IRMA. And what IRMA is income-related monthly adjustment amount. And so Dagmar is trying to figure out what's going on. And when she registers for Medicare, which she'll be eligible really soon, are they going to come after her as well? Rachel?
This is a great question and something that catches a lot of people off guard about the Medicare program. So what Dagmar and her husband are experiencing is the fact that Medicare looks back 2 years at your tax return to calculate if you are required to pay IRMA. That's because it's the last return that they have on file. So in this case, if they sold in 2022, that capital gain showed up on their 2022 tax return, which is then used to determine if they need to pay IRMA and have higher premium payments made starting in 2024, even if they were already on Medicare. Now, one thing to note is that this does normalize and your premiums will return to normal once the sale falls off of that 2-year look back window. So once more than 2 years have passed since you sold the property, your premiums will return to normal. And in Dagmar's case, since she sold the house more than 3 years before becoming Medicare eligible, it should not impact her premiums. And actually, a lot of advisors do advise if you are going to sell a home or something like that, to do it before you turn 63 to prevent something like this from happening. Now, if this was a one-time income bump, which it was in Dagmar's case, and your current income is not that high, you can file an IRMA appeal on the Social Security website, which is ssa.gov/Medicare. And so this is something that comes up with a lot of folks because the age of eligibility for Medicare is often around the age that folks are thinking about downsizing their home. And with the appreciation in home value, this can trigger IRMA for a lot of people who are not expecting it. But you can appeal it, and also it will be it will have a 1 year effect on your premiums, and then they will normalize once you get past that 2 year window.
Thank you, Rachel. Our next question is from Carrie from California, also who called in. She had a traumatic brain injury in September and was hospitalized and then had home health services for PT. At the end of October, they transitioned her to outpatient. She was in the hospital in September. She started up PT in November, but Anthem, her insurance, is charging her a penalty charge because she didn't have pre-authorization. She filed an appeal and it was denied. The insurance and the provider are pointing fingers at each other. So Louise, what's happening here and what can Carrie do?
So Carrie, I'm sorry for everything you've been through because it sounds like a lot. Unfortunately, not getting prior authorization for a service that your plan requires it on is a valid reason for a claim denial or the sort of penalty charge that you're seeing. So there's no guarantee that the appeals process will work in your favor. But that said, you should definitely continue the appeals process. So since you mentioned that the insurer and the provider are pointing fingers at each other, one thing that sometimes helps is to try to get them on a three-way call with you, or depending on how things are going right now with your care, a trusted advisor who can be in your place, and then the provider and the insurer all on the same call together. That does make it harder for them just to sort of keep kicking the can back and forth to each other if they can all discuss it in one call. Since the initial appeal got denied, that appeal denial notice should have included instructions on how to proceed to the next step of the appeals process, which is an external review. And that's where if your internal appeal that you submitted directly to the insurance plan gets denied, you, on most plans, you have the right to an external review, which is where an independent third party, oftentimes it's the state insurance department, but it can be a different party, will review the facts of the case and see if the initial appeal denial can be overturned. Your provider and your care team, the physical therapy team, your doctor who initially called for that, should definitely be involved in the process of completing all the information for that external review. The more details they can provide, the better, in terms of any extenuating circumstances that were going on, why the prior authorization wasn't obtained. So again, going back to what I said at the beginning, there's no guarantee this will work out. There's never a guarantee with appeals, and the need for prior authorization is grounds for a plan to not pay a claim they would otherwise have paid. But people are often successful when they keep going through that external review process. So definitely work with your care team to try to complete that whole process and see how it goes.
Thank you, Louise. And also a couple weeks ago, we had Neil Shaw from Counterforce Health on the show, and he talked about their free tool, which helps for writing appeal letters. So you may want to check that out too. That's at counterforcehealth.org. That may be helpful as you go through the appeals process. So Rachel, Medicare Advantage open enrollment continues until the end of March. What should people be aware of right now, and what do they need to do before the end of the month?
This is a very important time, and people really need to be aware of what they can and can't do during Medicare Advantage open enrollment. So right now, anybody who is already in a Medicare Advantage plan, those are the people who can make changes to their Medicare coverage. What you can do during this time is you can switch from one Medicare Advantage plan to another, or you can drop your Medicare Advantage plan and return to original Medicare, and you'll also be able to purchase a Medicare Part D drug plan if you choose to do that. So if you're happy with your current coverage, you don't need to do anything. However, if you're thinking about switching from one Medicare Advantage plan to another Medicare Advantage plan, just make sure you are aware of obstacles that Medicare Advantage plans can have to you getting the care that you need. This can be things like narrow networks that don't include the providers that you typically go to, or requiring prior authorization for services that original Medicare does not require prior authorization for. And it's important to note, often when you switch between Medicare Advantage plans, if you have a treatment or a medication that you're on that has already been authorized either through prior authorization or step therapy on one plan, those approvals often do not transfer to your next plan. So you may have to go through that process again. If you're switching from a Medicare Advantage plan back to original Medicare, you will not have to deal with those narrow networks and the burdens of prior authorization, but you need to be aware that you will need to buy a separate Part D drug plan and that there's no out-of-pocket cap for original Medicare right now, though there really should be, and we should fight for that. You may right now need to buy a supplemental plan, often called a Medigap plan. And many states allow Medigap plans when you're switching from Medicare Advantage back to original Medicare to put you through what's called medical underwriting when you apply to be in their plan. This essentially means that they can ask you questions about your health status and they can deny you coverage or charge you a higher premium based on your pre-existing conditions. So there are a lot of things that you need to be aware of when you're switching between Medicare Advantage plans and from Medicare Advantage to traditional Medicare or original Medicare. But the biggest things to keep in mind are Medicare Advantage plans often come with specific networks of providers that you can see. So you can't see every provider that accepts Medicare. And they often come with a much higher burden of prior authorization than original Medicare.
Thank you, Rachel. And thank you, everybody who joined us today to learn more about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America. Be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. And please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more Care Talk. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. MSW Media.